Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today feels different. Usually we're looking at something a bit abstract, tech trends, history, maybe some obscure economic theory. But today, we're heading straight into the eye of a storm that's happening right now.
It really is. It's late January 2026, and the atmosphere, specifically here in Minnesota, is, well, it's incredibly tense.
If you've been anywhere near a newsfeed, you've seen the headlines. Operation Metro Surge.
Right.
And depending on which channel you watch or which feed you scroll, you're getting two completely contradictory realities.
That's the most disorienting part. On one side, you have the federal government's official narrative.
Yeah.
You watch the press briefings, and it looks like a blockbuster action movie. They've got photos of hardened criminals, all the gear, the rhetoric about the worst of the worst.
This looks like a victory lap for public safety.
Exactly. We are finally cleaning up the streets. But then you talk to people on the ground. You look at local reports, and the story isn't about master criminals. It's about, well, it's about a 5-year-old child being used as bait.
And that disconnect, that massive gap, is exactly why we're doing this deep dive. Our mission today isn't to shout slogans or pick a team.
No, we are allergic to slogans here.
We are.
Our job is to look at the raw data. We have a document in front of us titled Metro Surge Analysis, dated January 23, 2026. This isn't an op-ed. This is court documents, ACLU filings, internal government memos.
So we're going to deconstruct the paperwork, figure out who was actually being detained, how this operation is, you know, mechanically working. And we need to talk about this legal tug of war between the state and the feds.
It's a constitutional mess, frankly.
But let's start with the people.
Yes.
Okay. So the central claim of this whole operation, the government says this is necessary to target high-level criminals. That's the justification.
That's the pitch, yes.
So looking at the actual arrest data, does that claim hold water?
If you look at the numbers, no.
Right.
It really doesn't. The analysis has national data from late 2025, and it paints a very different picture. As of late last year, approximately 73.6% of ICE detainees had no criminal convictions.
Wait, hold on. Almost three quarters.
73.6%.
The people they have in custody have a clean record.
Correct. No criminal convictions whatsoever.
But how do they square that with the worst of the worst rhetoric? I mean, if I tell you I'm going fishing for sharks and I come back with 75% minnows, you'd question my method.
That's a great analogy. And if you look at the first 9 months of the current administration, something like 75,000 people arrested had no criminal record.
Wow.
So this isn't a precision strike. It's a dragnet. It is, by design, sweeping up non-criminals.
Okay, but non-criminals is a sterile term. It's easy to gloss over.
Yeah.
When we dig into the specifics in this report, we're talking about families. We're talking about kids.
This is the part of the report that is genuinely difficult to read. The source material highlights the Columbia Heights Public School District. In just a 2-week span this month, January 2026, the district reported 4 students detained.
4 students in 2 weeks.
And the details of how. Well, let's just look at the case of Liam Conejo Ramos.
This is the 5-year-old.
Yes, 5 years old.
I need to pause on that. 5. He's in kindergarten.
The report states that masked agents allegedly used him as bait. They detained the child to force his father to come out of the home.
I'm trying to even visualize that. Tactical teams, weapons, and they're holding a kindergartner to get leverage on a parent.
That is the allegation in the legal filing. And Liam wasn't an isolated incident. The report also details a 10-year-old girl apprehended while walking to school with her mother.
Walking to school.
And a 17-year-old taken after agents pushed the way into an apartment. These aren't people hiding in some bunker.
No. And this dragnet, it's not just catching undocumented immigrants. The filter, so to speak, is so wide as catching U.S. citizens, too.
Right.
How does that happen? I mean, if you're a citizen, you have rights. They can't just grab you, can they?
Well, theoretically, yes. But in practice, under this operation, we're seeing what are called suspicionless stops.
It just sounds Orwellian.
It feels that way. There's a legal filing mentioned, Hussein v. Noam, a 20-year-old U.S. citizen, Mubashir Khalif Hussein. He was stopped by masked agents in Minneapolis.
Okay.
And he did everything you're supposed to do. He asserted his citizenship repeatedly. They detained him anyway. When you remove the need for specific suspicion, when agents can stop anyone based on a hunch or, let's be honest, a profile. Citizens get caught in the gears.
And we should be clear. Many of the people being detained, like the family of that 5-year-old Liam, they aren't fugitives.
No, and that's a critical point. Many have active legal asylum cases. They're in the system. They're checking in. They have no standing deportation orders.
So this brings me to the big question. If the data shows they aren't mostly criminals, and they're grabbing kids and asylum seekers and even citizens, why? What is the incentive? Is there a quota?
Ah, the Q word. The government will always officially deny quotas. But the source material points to a directive from May 2025 issued by high-level officials, including DHS Secretary Kristi Noem. It is explicitly called the 3,000 per day national directive.
3,000 human beings a day.
That is the target.
Yeah.
And you can't hit a national number like that without strict local targets. The report indicates the St. Paul field office has a target of roughly 75 arrests per day.
Okay, play devil's advocate for a second. In sales, you have quotas. In a factory, you have production goals. Why is it wrong for law enforcement to have performance metrics?
That's a fair question, but in law enforcement, when you set a volume target, you must arrest 75 people today, you change the entire incentive. You stop looking for the needle in the haystack, the dangerous criminal, and you start just grabbing the hay.
So the quality of the arrest goes out the window.
Completely, because quantity is all that matters. There was a telling interaction on January 22nd with Greg Bovino, the Border Patrol commander. A reporter asked him about these targets. His response, there is a number. It's called all of them.
It's called all of them. That doesn't sound like law enforcement. That sounds like cleaning house.
It sounds like a vacuum cleaner. And that philosophy explains the tactics we're seeing. The report describes collateral arrests.
What does that mean legally?
Imagine agents go to a workplace looking for one specific person, but they have a quota. So instead of just taking that one person, they detain everyone there. Coworkers, bystanders, just to boost the numbers.
And to do that,
yeah,
they can't possibly have warrants for all those random people.
They don't. And this is where we have to get a little technical, because this is the mechanism that allows this. They're using what are called administrative warrants.
Okay, unpack that. Because to me, a warrant is a warrant. It means the police can come in. What's the difference?
This is the deep dive moment. A standard judicial warrant, the kind you see on TV, is signed by a judge. A judge reviews evidence, finds probable cause, and that lets police enter your home.
Okay, so that's the gold standard.
Right. An administrative warrant, which ICE uses, is not signed by a judge. It's signed by an immigration official. Basically, their boss signs it.
So it's an internal document.
It is. And legally, it does not grant authority to enter a private home without consent.
So if an agent shows up with one of those, I can just say no thank you and close the door?
Legally, yes. It's basically an invitation that looks like an order. But the report suggests agents are operating under internal memos that encourage them to act as if they have judicial authority.
So they're banking on people not knowing the difference.
Exactly. They use the confusion, the fear, the police patches. They bypass the judicial system to keep the numbers up.
That's a massive loophole. But let's swing back to the government's defense. On January 20th, President Trump held a press briefing. He held up photos. He said, look at these criminals we caught in Minnesota.
Right.
If the operation is just grabbing random people, who were those guys in the photos?
This is a classic case of, well, statistical sleight of hand. Mm. The administration claimed over 3,000 arrests in Minnesota. But when asked to back up the criminal narrative with names, DHS only released about 240 names.
That's less than 10%.
Right. But it gets worse. The analysis found that about 70 people on that worst of the worst list, they were already in federal prisons in Minnesota.
Wait. What? They were already locked up.
Yes, they weren't roaming the streets. Moving them from a federal prison cell to an ICE detention cell isn't a capture. It's paperwork. But it counts as an arrest for the press release.
That is incredibly misleading. What about the accusation that Minnesota is refusing to turn over criminals? That's a huge talking point.
And it's factually incorrect, according to the data. In 2025, the MN Department of Corrections transferred 84 people to ICE. They honor detainers. In fact, many people in those photos were transferred months ago, last August or November.
So they're taking credit for arrests that happened last year to justify what they're doing now.
Precisely. And even some of the so-called high-profile names on the list, their criminal history is limited to traffic tickets or DWIs.
I mean, a DWI isn't good, but it's not exactly Hannibal Lecter.
No, it's performance. And while the federal government is performing, the state of Minnesota is tearing itself apart legally.
Let's get into this legal war. You have Attorney General Keith Ellison saying one thing and local sheriffs saying another.
It is a state completely divided, a federalism crisis. The AG, Keith Ellison, issued an opinion in December 2025. He said, sheriffs, you cannot unilaterally sign these 287G agreements.
Quick definition. 287G.
It's the federal program that deputizes local cops to act like ICE agents, Ellison said. Your county board has to vote on it.
And the sheriff said,
watch us. Especially in rural and suburban counties, Sherburne, Candiohe, Freeborn, they're ignoring the AG, citing public safety and their own autonomy.
And why do they want to? Is it just politics?
Politics is part of it, but it's also financial. Counties get paid to house detainees. Sherburne County is a major detention hub. That's a revenue stream.
So in Sherburne County, the local police are effectively ICE. But if you're in Minneapolis,
it's a totally different world. Hennepin and Ramsey counties, the Twin Cities, are sanctuary jurisdictions. They refuse to honor detainers unless a judge signs them.
So it's a standoff.
A total standoff.
Yeah.
You have local police protecting residents from federal agents in one county and helping them in the next.
And speaking of geography, there's a note about Woodbury. For listeners who don't know, Woodbury is a pretty quiet, affluent suburb.
Which is why this is so shocking. DHS documents identified a warehouse in Woodbury as a potential site for a massive new detention center.
How big are we talking?
Capacity for 1,500 people.
1,500? That's not a jail. That's an encampment in a suburb.
It shows the scale of what they're planning. You don't build a 1,500-person facility unless you plan on filling it.
With all this tension, the quotas, the kids, the warehouse rumors, it was bound to boil over, and tragically, it did.
The flashpoint was the fatal shooting of Renee Good by a federal agent in Minneapolis early this January. That shifted the dynamic from enforcement to open conflict.
The protests have been massive. But the response to the protests sounds like a war zone. Tear gas.
Tear gas, pepper spray, rubber bullets. And not just against riots. The reports and videos show these tactics being used on peaceful protesters, on legal observers.
But didn't a judge stop this? I remember reading about an injunction.
This is what we're calling legal whiplash. On January 16th, Judge Kate Menendez issued an injunction. She said, I see you cannot arrest peaceful protesters. Stop it.
Okay, so a win for civil liberties.
For 5 days. On January 21st, the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals issued a stay on that injunction.
Explain stay like I'm five.
A stay is a pause button. Judge Menendez hit stop. The appeals court hit pause on her order. So effectively, the stop button is broken right now.
So as of today, the gloves are off again.
Yes. ICE has the green light to use those tactics again while the appeal winds its way through the court.
That's terrifying. And for the people already detained, what are the conditions like?
The ACLU describes them as inhumane, and that's not a word they throw around. We're seeing specific allegations of medical neglect, people being denied insulin, heart medication.
Denying insulin is a death sentence.
It is. There are reports of extreme temperatures, lack of hygiene supplies. This is what happens when you prioritize volume. When you flood the system with 75 arrests a day, the infrastructure just collapses.
It's a nightmare scenario. If you're listening to this and you're scared or you know someone who is, there are resources. We want to make sure we give you those.
Absolutely. For legal help, reach out to the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota ILCM or the Advocates for Human Rights.
And for real-time info. If you see something happening,
there's the Monarca hotline. It's community run for tracking raids. And to find someone, there's the ICE online detainee locator, or you can check local jail rosters in places like Sherburne and Condiohe counties directly.
We will put all of those names in the show notes. Please check them.
Please do.
So let's try to pull this all together. What's the big picture here?
I think the core tension, the thing that defines this moment, is a battle between volume and justice.
Volume versus justice.
You have a federal mandate that says, get me numbers. Get me 3,000 a day. Get me all of them. And when you prioritize volume, the system breaks. You stop caring if the person is a criminal or a student. You stop caring if you have a real warrant or just a piece of paper.
It feels like the machinery is just eating everything in its path to feed that number.
It is. And here's the thing everyone needs to understand. Regardless of where they stand on immigration, the methods matter.
Right.
If the government can enter a home without a judicial warrant, if they can detain minors to coerce parents, those are precedents. Those powers don't just vanish when this operation ends. They stay in the toolkit.
They erode civil liberties for everyone.
For everyone, citizen and non-citizen alike.
That's the part that stays with me. If they can do it to them, the machinery is built to do it to you. I want to leave you with a final thought to chew on. We started this with the government's claim that this is about public safety. But we learned that 75% of the people arrested have no criminal record. So I have to ask, at what point does public safety stop being the goal and start becoming just a cover for public performance? At what point are we destroying families and bypassing the Constitution just to make a chart look good in a briefing room? That is the question everyone needs to be asking right now. Thank you for listening to this deep dive. It's a heavy one, but it's important. Stay safe, stay informed, and check the notes for those legal aid numbers. We'll see you next time.